The Boise State Public Radio app. News, music, and more.
Idaho Matters.
Morning Edition.
All things considered.
The Connector.
And more.
And more.
You can take us wherever you go and stay connected. Without it, you're missing out. Download it free.
You can also communicate using the Talk to Us tab.
The Boise State Public Radio app.
Friday, February 15th, 2019. You're listening to Idaho Matters. Hi, I'm George Prentice, sitting in for Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, where we break down all the news that made headlines this week. Joining us live in studio today are Scott McIntosh with Idaho Press, Seth Ogilvy with Idaho Public Television, and Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television and the Idaho Statesman.
Hey, George.
Gentlemen.
Hey, George. How's it going?
Hello.
Let's start where we usually end many of our weeks, at the Idaho State House. Where are we with redistricting?
Well, with redistricting, we're kind of in a holding pattern. There was a bill that passed out of committee. I think this was last week. They all kind of start blurring together at this point. The Democrats went to the floor of the House, and in protest, they started having the clerk read the bills, which basically just slows things down in the legislative process. It wasn't a huge gesture because there was only three bills. I think it only ended up being about five pages. It wasn't a huge delay, but I think they made their point that they were willing to slow everything down, drag their feet, because they felt like not enough people got input into this redistricting bill. Then leadership decided, hey, we've heard you. We don't want this to seem like a partisan thing, although inevitably it's always going to be a partisan thing. I mean, this has been on the platform of the Idaho Republican Party for a very long time. A lot of Republicans have been looking at the redistricting commission and saying, why is this 3-3? We run this state. You know, they've got like a two-thirds majority. Why should we share this power?
Isn't it technically called the Independent Redistricting Commission?
It is. And surprisingly, it's the when you look at transparency in government and open government and ethics in government, it's the one thing in Idaho that we actually get rated really well on. Mm-hmm. We get an A grade for our redistricting commission, and we get like D's and F's for almost everything else. But we do end up in court when it comes to redistricting. We have a couple of years. And a lot of times it is actually for how the lines are drawn or certain technical issues, not because of how the commission is made up. But I think people are kind of putting those two things together and saying if we had a seventh person to break a tie, we wouldn't end up in court. The process would go a whole lot smoother.
Is there a sense of constituent pushback on that initial plan?
There was in the initial hearings. A lot of people showed up, but you also have to take into consideration the locality of the capital. It's, you know, there's the north end of Boise, which is maybe one of the liberalest places in all of Idaho, is a couple blocks away. So the people that showed up are going to obviously have more of a Democratic bent. All that being said, it's going back into committee. And at the end of the day, they're going to need a two-thirds because this would be a constitutional amendment. But as I said before, the Republicans have two-thirds in both bodies. There's probably a very good likelihood that if they want to do this, they can do this. They just have to figure out if they want to take the political heat or not. There's been a couple of other options on the table, maybe still keeping the six and having the six nominate a possible seventh person themselves. The current bill would let the constitutional officers, I think minus the Secretary of State and the Attorney General, because they didn't want them involved, nominate the seventh person.
You're getting really technical now.
Basically, the Republicans would get to nominate the seventh
person. And if this goes to a ballot, it would need a simple majority?
It would need a simple majority after two-thirds in both houses.
Two-thirds in both houses, right. So ostensibly, it takes more than a majority to get to the people and then – and then a majority from the people. I was impressed by what former Judge Lansing said, which was, you know, the whole notion of having a 3-3 balance is the point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are we worrying about a tiebreaker? We should be thinking about a plan where six people can find a majority among themselves. And so I think you know, in Idaho, it's the one thing, like Seth said, that gets us good reviews for transparency and accountability. It's the one place we still have kind of good government, bipartisanship guaranteed. And I think if it got to the people, I think it would still be a big lift. Yes, Republicans are in charge, and yes, they are the majority, but I still think people don't want to endorse partisanship.
And there has been some talk of maybe adding a seventh person, but making it a supermajority for a vote, meaning 5 out of 7 people would have to vote in favor of it. So there would at least have to be a Democrat that signed off on it. I think this is still kind of early in the sausage making. I mean, there is next year, and if they worked really fast the year after that, that they could still do this plan over the next 2 years before the redistricting commission would actually have to meet.
Can you give us a real quick update on Medicaid expansion?
So we are at the 90-day deadline. When Prop 2 passed, they said that something has to be done by 90 days. 90 days, according to the Health and Welfare Department, is Monday. So they have a draft legislation. I did a story on this earlier this week that basically is what we all refer to as a clean Medicaid expansion. It just expands Medicaid. It doesn't put any sideboards up. It doesn't put anything on that. They're going to send that out either today. They may have already done it. I haven't checked in with them. Or Monday. And then the likelihood is the federal government will be fine with that. They've, you know, this is something that's passed in other states. There's no weird technicalities here. So that will likely be out there. And if the legislature doesn't do anything come January 1st, that will be the plan for Idaho. And you can start enrolling in that if you're in the gap population for Medicaid here in Idaho. That's probably not how it's going to play out. There's several sideboards that the Idaho legislature are looking at. One is a opt-out, basically, if the funding changes. Right now, 90% would come from – 90% would come from the federal government, 10% would come from the state. They want a clause in there basically saying if that changes, we're not doing this plan anymore. The other idea would be a work requirement of some sort or training that – would probably follow kind of either an optional program that we have here in Idaho or the SNAP program kind of requirements. That would ensure that people are either training to get better work or working. Now, if you remember right, this gap population is mostly working poor, so the majority of them are working already.
And I think that requirement already exists for food stamps in Idaho.
It does.
You've got to be on some kind of plan to be
exactly
getting employment or currently employed.
Yeah, and they're just going to – they're thinking about taking that and moving up onto this Medicaid gap population. The other thing that they are looking at is there's a lot of legislators that are concerned about Planned Parenthood's involvement in this. They do receive Medicaid money and they do receive federal grants.
But we've seen that movie before. It's pretty limited. It's extremely limited.
It is absolutely limited, and the large majority of it goes to cervical cancer and breast cancer screening. That's mostly the Medicaid money that they receive. None of this money, this wouldn't fund abortions. That's not what this insurance money would go to. But there's a group of folks at the Idaho legislature that are uncomfortable with any of this money possibly going to Planned Parenthood. So there might be a sideboard put in there. That's the one that probably complicates this whole thing.
Scott, I'd like to talk a little bit about a fascinating story that Idaho Press had this week from the State House on a hearing that proposes Idaho inmates to help solve, or at least partially solve, a work shortage on Idaho farms. And this hearing had a really interesting reunion.
Yeah, it was kind of a surprise. This was Patty Ann Lodge. She's been working on this bill. This is a bill that would expand, you know, and we don't want to call it inmate labor. This is job training for inmates. I think this is kind of to get around some sort of work requirements and work compensation requirements. We can talk about that later. But during this hearing, a young woman testified in favor of this bill, saying that she was an inmate and worked in the orchards and was just – it was such a benefit to her. And our reporter, Tommy Simmons, was talking to Patty Ann Lodge after the hearing, and Patty Ann Lodge said, oh, she used to be a student of mine at this hearing. So that was really interesting. And this is a bill that would expand existing state law to include not just agriculture endeavors that deal with perishable items. So the idea is that, well, we get prisoners out into the field to pick peaches and apples and cherries before they rot on the vine. And this bill would expand that to allow other businesses, agricultural businesses that don't deal with just perishable items. And so it has a lot of benefits. You know, there are definitely great benefits to the people who use it, and it did pass out of committee. And
so the appetite's pretty good for this measure so far?
Yeah, I think there are some concerns, legitimate concerns about it's a little bit of a subsidy for industry. So it's cheap labor for certain businesses.
But if there is a work shortage.
There is a work shortage. Yeah. But the argument would be, well, you know, we're a free market economy. So you just have to raise your wages and you'll get workers if you pay enough. And to some extent, this allows these businesses to not pay as much. So that's the opposition to it. Whether that's enough to kill it, I don't think so.
Does it drop into the Department of Correction budget then? Would it be an IDOC item?
It's under the Department of Corrections budget, but their money is self-sustaining. They get a permission from JFAC to spend the money, but all of the money is self-funding. So if you look at the money over the last couple of years, normally they spend about I think it's about $3 million on just costs that go into it, maybe about $4 million on random other services, but they make about $16 million. So that $8 million that's left over afterwards will recycle into the program and they'll either use it next year or so on. Can't quite figure out, doing the math myself, looking into it, I couldn't quite figure out where the excess money goes. But if you look at the trends, about 5 years ago, they were having a lot more profits that they were having to deal with. There were a few audits that were done of the correctional industries program to see where that money was going. The other interesting trend that you see, it's there's a lot more. It's almost doubled in the amount of agricultural and food processing work that's been done over the last decade. And they are moving this way. And you have people working in food processing plants and, as you're saying, working out in orchards and possibly on farms when there's an emergency need to get that food out of there. So it's expanding even before the legislation's happened.
Bill, you had a great story in The Statesman this week where you took us with you to D.C.
Correct.
To meet a familiar name.
For Keith some Allred, of us.
And I had no idea that this was his new mission in life. It's right. Fascinating.
Right. So Keith Allred, most people will remember, he ran for governor in 2010. He had run the common interest from 2005 to 2010, which was a nonpartisan, bipartisan kind of policy shop. They would gather their membership together. They'd come up with positions, and they would take them to the legislature. He was really known for being an independent and nonpartisan.
Some people were surprised he even ran as a Democrat.
He was lobbied by the Democratic Party to run for governor and in 2010 against Butch Otter, and so he agreed to do it, and he lost. It wasn't close, and he says then, you know, once he had kind of cast his lot with a party, he had to spend some time, he called it letting the radioactive half-life dissipate. And so he kind of disappeared from public life, and he was consulting for some big businesses and helping them do a leadership and strategic planning. And he's kind of reemerged now as head of the National Institute for Civil Discourse in Washington, D.C. But most interesting, I think, for Idahoans is he has this idea to reconstitute the common interest on a national level, calling it Common Sense American. And he hopes to kind of apply what he learned doing this work in Idaho on a national scale.
And my sense is that his optimism comes from constituents and not necessarily from those men and women who are currently in office.
Well, I think anybody who works in this field thinks that the solution to dealing with American kind of partisanship and gridlock is going to have to come from the grassroots up. It's not going to happen from the top down. And there is a lot of pessimism that anything can be done. But, you know, this is a really smart guy, maybe too smart, right? He's so wonky. He can sometimes get lost in the details. But he has this real passion for the work. He studied at Harvard. He taught at Harvard. He knows what he's talking about. He's a historian as well as a mediation expert. So if there's anybody who can kind of figure out what to do, maybe he can do it.
But there are some who might think this is the worst time. We've never been more divided. And then, quite frankly, it's probably the best time because we've never been more divided.
I think that's what he would argue. He wondered if there would ever be interest in trying to do the common interest model on a national level. And I think his point is, if it's ever going to resonate with people, now's the time.
I'm George Prentiss, sitting in for Gemma Gaudette. Let's get back to our reporter roundtable for the week. Joining us today, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Press, Seth Ogilvie with Idaho Press Television, and Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television and Idaho Statesman. Scott, let's talk about two measures, unrelated measures, that have surfaced at the State House. That said, they do have alcohol in common.
Right. There are a couple of alcohol-related bills. One of them is a bill introduced Wednesday to let historic theaters like the Egyptian Theater in Boise and the Pix Theater in Nampa to serve beer and wine. This is kind of a right around existing state law that doesn't allow theaters to serve beer and alcohol under certain restrictions. And so this would allow theaters that are historic, at least that were built before 1950 and are on the National Historic Register.
Are there
National Historic Places?
More than
there
just
are
a couple?
Are
yeah, there
half
are
a dozen?
A
few. There, apparently, there are 13 such theaters in operation in Idaho, including in eastern Idaho, the Colonial Theater in Idaho Falls, the Romance Theater in Rexburg, the Roxy Theater in St. Anthony, and, like I said, the Pix Theater in Nampa. That would benefit from this, and this would make it easier for them to serve beer and wine in their theaters.
And I know at the Egyptian, I think they can do it, but they have to. They can't allow anyone through the doors if they're under 21. So they actually have 21 and over screenings of classic films, but and that's it.
Right, right, and this would allow more freedom to serve beer and wine.
No, and I've actually had a beer there at a mayoral event.
Hmm.
At the Egyptian. So I'm kind of curious if the city of Boise was breaking the rules or if
ooh,
I was.
Like,
I'm kind of curious now because I'm pretty sure there were kids there.
Well, it gets very interesting, though, with Idaho's history and serving alcohol when there is entertainment, particularly up on the screen. We've had this debate a few times. It's
Absolutely. Actually
played out in the court a couple of times. We have two theaters that have been grandfathered in, and that is the Flicks in Boise and Magic Lantern in Sun Valley, and then, of course, the Village at Meridian has a 21 and over area. But anytime an R-rated film or worse goes up on the screen, people get nervous when there's alcohol.
Well, there was a big to do when they wanted to the movie, it was Blue something, out at the Village, and the state police shut them down, and there's been this kind of weird relationship between alcohol regulation and movies, and of course it came out of the days when you couldn't have nude bars, and so you couldn't serve alcohol.
But they shackled them to the pornography laws.
And to theaters who are showing R-rated movies that no one would think should be involved in alcohol regulation.
And yet these are the movies that win Oscars.
You know, Idaho just has this really strange history with prohibition and temperance, and the Idaho Constitution to this day, you know, has this phrase about guaranteeing the temperance of its citizens. And so we are totally screwed up as a state when it comes to dealing with these issues.
Which leads us to the second measure.
So there's another bill that was passed passed out of committee this week that would allow alcohol service in plazas. So this was introduced by Representative Scott Syme of Caldwell. And, of course, the Indian Creek Plaza in Caldwell would be a beneficiary of this legislation. And it would kind of expand. If you have a liquor license to serve alcohol in a specific place, you're kind of limited. But if you want to have four or five wineries get together at the Indian Creek Plaza and do a wine tasting, well, do you have to stay at that one winery's table and then put your wine down and then go walk over to the other? This bill would allow free movement with alcohol throughout the plaza. And it led to an interesting, funny quote from Representative Randy Armstrong of Income. He said, quote, "It really warms my heart that every day we come here and we find more ways to offer alcohol to the general public." And he was kind of quipping about that. And he's vice chairman of the committee, and he actually did vote in favor of the
So
the
both
bill.
Of these bills have passed out of committee?
Mm-hmm, and they're headed to the House floor.
But the one that is in trouble is the one that would regulate the way alcohol licenses are handed out, which is another strange Idaho tale, and which involves this kind of incredibly arcane system for, you know, selling liquor licenses. And if any time you go to change that, of course, then you may be depriving the people who've paid big money to get these.
So that is in trouble?
It is, and it was sent
back. And again, the
back.
Measure initially was going to push down some oversight or authority to municipal
cities.
Levels.
Right, okay. Right. So a city like Boise, which yeah. doesn't have any more allotment of liquor licenses, and so people on the waiting list are waiting for a license, or they can pay $120,000, $180,000 on the secondary market for a liquor license, or they can wait and pay, what, $75 for a state liquor license.
And there is a lot of money wrapped up in that secondary yeah. market. Oh, there's yeah. a lot of people with huge investments. Yeah. So I think you encounter two kind of pushbacks when you're trying to expand the liquor laws here. One, obviously, is folks who are just not in favor of alcohol and think it's right. immoral to offer all those things. But the second is there's an industry built up around this. I mean, that's – if I had $150,000 right. sitting there waiting to be sold off, I'm not terribly interested in, you know, flooding the market with new liquor laws.
People who bought a liquor license for $20,000 a few years ago and holding on to it just for the hope of right. selling it for $180,000. So, you know, I got to hand it to Senator Jim Rice for coming up with this. It's convoluted and complicated, but it would be a somewhat of a solution to this problem.
And mm-hmm. normally those solutions start up north. So it's kind of odd that it's starting down here in the valley. Normally they start up north. They get pushback from southeastern Idaho. And in the Treasure Valley is kind of the battleground on where that liquor law is going to end up.
Right. And Jim Rice himself, he said, you know, I'm Mormon. I don't drink alcohol. So this is not, you know, I'm not interested in this at all, but I want to solve this problem.
And indeed, maybe that's the champion that Bill may need.
That's a good point.
Nixon going to China.
Speaking of 21 and over, I'd be remiss if we didn't turn to a very sad story, but important story, and that is the sentencing this week of Sarah Kester, the mother accused of failing to report her husband's sexual abuse of their children.
Yeah, she was sentenced yesterday, and the sentencing hearing was pretty heart-wrenching. Three of her daughters testified in this case. And this is a case where her husband, Lester Kester, was molesting his children and another relative for several years, and Sarah Kester knew about it. And at one point, three of her daughters came to her and told her about the molestation in an effort to protect their youngest daughter. Well, Sarah Kester's response to that was to pray that the demons would leave her husband. She tried to keep him busy so that he wouldn't molest their children. She called her own daughters sluts and whores and allowed the abuse to continue for years. And the girls, three of the girls testified yesterday. Sarah Kester had told police that it was against her religious beliefs to report to the police. And that's why she didn't report to the police. And so they are part of the Followers of Christ Church. And so this ties into the whole faith healing element. And she was sentenced to a one-year rider program with 119 days credit served. So she could be out, in a few months after
that. If she fails, just for the record, if she fails, it's a minimum of four. It's four fixed.
Right. Four fixed, 10 years max. So it could be 10 years in prison, but a four years prison minimum.
You know, the notion of being able to hide behind a God defense in a case like this is pretty sad, but if there's a silver lining, it may be that it kind of brings into more stark contrast this notion that children don't deserve protection because their parents have a faith that that wouldn't let them get protection, whether it's from a doctor or from law enforcement. So maybe this can serve as a vehicle to explore this issue with a little more, I think, concern for the children rather than just the religious rights of the parents.
And indeed, if there's any movement on that issue, it's to take faith out of the equation.
Mm-hmm. We'll see.
And to remember, like, faith isn't necessarily an excuse for the action. Sometimes when it comes to the faith healing issue, faith is an excuse for the inaction.
Correct.
Which I know it's semantic, but I think it is important.
Scott, we have just a couple more minutes, and so I apologize because I know that this is a complex tale, but can you bring us up to speed on water in Eagle,
Yeah.
And the Eagle Water Company that Suez wants to buy, now the city of Eagle wants to buy, and even the city of Boise is weighing in on this.
Right, because this is a private water company in Eagle that serves about 4,000 customers, and it's a gentleman, 78-year-old guy who wants to retire, and he's put it up for sale in Suez.
Global company.
Multinational French-based company that is also serves the city of Boise, has about 250,000 customers in the Treasure Valley. They put an offer to purchase the Eagle Water Company for $10 million. Currently, Eagle Water Company customers pay about $12 a month for their water. People in Boise pay about $25. And there's concern among residents in Eagle that their bill is going to double or more. They have enlisted the help of Norm Semenko, a name that we probably haven't heard in a long time.
Former chairman of the Republican Party.
So he is
very involved in water issues.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Definitely an expert in water issues, but trying to stop the sale of the Eagle Water Company. The city of Eagle now is saying, well, we want to buy it. And the owner of the Eagle Water Company says, well, you could have bought it many times over the years, and you never said anything.
It's a
private company. Yeah. And so it will be going to the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, on March 4th. And so we'll see whether that sale will be allowed to go ahead.
And how is Boise weighing in on any of this?
Well, they're against it. I don't know exactly the arguments against it that they have, but, they're concerned about rates going up for everybody. So it's entirely possible that if Suez gets more and more water customers, they could have a little bit of a monopoly on the market and charge whatever they want.
Okay. Bill, I'm going to give you a couple minutes for a plug. Idaho Experience just launched a new season, Night Before Last.
Yes. Well, a new episode.
This new episode.
This is your
third season, isn't it?
We're ending our second season.
Second season.
But this week we premiered Some Lived, an Idaho POW's story. It's a profile of a Meridian kid who went away to a pilot school, was shot down flying over Germany, and spent the rest of the war in a Nazi POW camp. It's a really heart-wrenching and tender story, told largely through in his own words. It was an independent production. It aired online and on air, and now you can still see it if you go to idahoptv.org and Google it or look for our on-air offerings. And then we are working on our next episode, which will be in April, and it's going to explore a religion that was founded and blossomed in Moscow in 1928, became one of the largest religions in the country, the largest mail order operation in the state, and the largest employer in Latah County, and you've never heard about it. It's called Psychiana, and stay tuned because it's a rollicking story.
The name alone is chilling, though.
It came to the founder, Frank B. Robinson, in a dream.
Psychiana.
Everything I've heard about this just is so intriguing.
Wow.
I got a little bit of a behind the scenes from Manny.
Psychological religion.
Boy, what a welcome to television.
Yes, thank you.
Bill, Scott, Seth, gentlemen, thank you.
I'm Gemma Gaudette, and this is Idaho Matters.